The CNBC app. Global market news in one place. Customizable sections and personalized alerts. Stocks tracking, interactive charts and market insights all in your hands. Stay connected. Stay informed. Download the CNBC app today.
A very good morning to you. Welcome to Squawk Box. So you've got Arabina Gamedi, you've got Karen Cho, you've got myself, Steve Sergi, and you've also got a surprise on US inflation, haven't you, everybody? Yes, US equities sell off and futures dip as traders now once again scaling back expectations for a June rate cut on the back of hotter than expected inflation. Now many eyeing a first move. Wait for it. You've got to wait till September. Well, Chinese deflationary pressures moving in the other direction, pointing to the potential, just the potential, for more government stimulus as CPI cools more than expected. Oh, how the US would like to see such headlines as that. Anyway, Chinese CPI cooling more than expected and producer prices sliding.
Too big to fail, the Swiss government strengthens its rules for the country's banking sector as it looks to prevent another collapse. South Korea's opposition parties deliver a crushing blow to President Yoon with a landslide win in the country's parliamentary election.
The ECB getting set for its latest rates decision then, with investors eyeing signs of divergence from the Fed.
Oh, good morning. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
You?
Very well, thank you.
To see you. I love the cognitive dissonance on markets sometimes as well, and how, to be fair, they're not down that much from their recent highs. So let's just put this in context. They've had the most roller coaster rally, even though interest rates and CPI haven't been playing ball as such as well. But I love the market. We don't look at CPI because it's not the Fed's favoured measure. But, PCE's not that great. Well, we can't really look at PCE. Let's look at core CPI instead because the headline figure's too volatile with food and energy. Oh, no, we can't look at core because it's including shelter. We don't like what we're seeing with shelter. So let's go for super core as well. Oh, yeah, that's safer ground. No, the super core is too hot. Well, what are we going to do? Go and find a super core, everybody. Yeah? Then you can justify your expectations for rate cuts. Because inflation, whatever metric you want to look at it, it's remaining sticky across the United States. Price pressures, hotter than expected in March, whether it's the headline, the core, the super core, you name it, I'm afraid. And it's just dented once again, hasn't it? Let's be honest about it. Those hopes that the Fed could start its rate cutting cycle in March. Oh, no, we've had March, remember? Oh, you got that wrong. Oh, well, no, it's June now. It's denting those prospects for June, potentially. Headline CPI rose 0.4% on the month, whilst the annual rate was 3.5%. The core readings also, as I might have mentioned, came in stronger than expected with shelter. That's the one they don't like. They're taking that one out, but unfortunately, it still didn't help. Shelter and energy costs driving gains. Well, as you might have expected, traders who... Let's be honest about it. You've got a pretty rubbish record on this rate cutting cycle so far, haven't you, traders? Anyway, traders slashed the odds of a rate cut in June with the CME's Fed futures now showing an 81% probability that the Fed keeps rates on hold. Isn't that extraordinary? Yeah. In comparison, around this time yesterday, futures indicated a more than 50% chance of a cut in June. And obviously, that graph has been coming down aggressively this year. Well, Goldman Sachs... The mighty Goldman Sachs now expects the Fed to cut just twice this year on the back of that report. Now, that's down from the three originally expected. That's not true, by the way. It originally expected a lot more than three, but we'll call it just the most recent expectation, shall we? The bank has also pushed back on its forecast for the first move from June to July. Now, I had on-the-record conversations and I had off-the-record conversation with Jan Hatzius, the Goldman Sachs chief economist. He told CNBC, though, that he's convinced that the U.S. economy is... deflating in some way.
I think it's possible that they cut in June and you could still get three cuts. I think that certainly could happen. But likewise, it's also possible that it moves back further. I mean, it's always very dependent on how the data come in. I think it tells you a lot more about the Fed than it tells you necessarily about the underlying adjustment in the economy. The disinflation, I still think a lot of the trends are improving, and you can see that in the labor market as well. But for the timing of Fed cuts, these numbers do matter.
So that was Jan not speaking to me last weekend, speaking, of course, to our US colleagues as well. He still thinks the disinflation trends are improving. My problem with that at the moment is you look at mortgage rates, you look at insurance, you look at shelter, it's not saying that picture.
Where exactly do you look now, to your point? And jobs report last week, that was also hot. We had the wing of hawkish members over at the Fed all sounding somewhat, I guess, stronger than what the market had anticipated at this point in the cycle. So a lot of warnings out there. And perhaps that was the reason why we didn't have an even bigger reversal yesterday. Those hawks very much managing the message in recent days, which is why we've seen a little bit of cooling off in the trade on the Dow yesterday, down more than 1%, similar range for the S&P 500. A little bit less coming off the NASDAQ, 0.8 down. If you look at the sectors that were hit, real estate, very interest rate sensitive. That was the worst performing part of the market. Energy was a slightly better performer by comparison. And if you drill down into various different components, banks, again, don't forget, you've seen real expectations change now around the timing and expectations of those rate cuts. If you look at the KBE, it was down 4% in session, down about 2.4% for the trading week. FANG stocks, those big technology names, also sliding yesterday in lockstep with the market, down about 0.9%. I want to take you to the Treasury action. Of course, we marched higher on the Treasuries, getting back towards those November levels, a four-month top on the two-year. We are just perched off the 5% handle, about 5 basis points shy of 5%, and in the territory to 7 basis points shy of 5% on the 10-year. So much more elevated, double-digit spike on both of these trades yesterday. And the high yield naturally supportive of the dollar trade. You're seeing that across the board. The dollar has climbed on the dollar index to a five-month high versus its major peers against some of those crosses, sterling dollar. You are seeing trying to claw back territory this morning, managing to put in about 0.1%, but we're trading below 125.5. Euro dollar in focus. Next central bank off the cab, and we are looking very much for the language from the ECB today as to whether they're still on track to be cutting rates by mid this year, or whether they're also waning disinflationary trends, elements they're watching. So this is the one we're all looking at on markets today, 107.45. Dollar yen too, well, we saw a decline to the 153 level yesterday. Lots of talk of intervention still, but the market, as a result, are just peeling back from some of those much weaker trades on yen in the past 24 hours. But we're still, as you can see, a dollar on the back foot now as yen tries to wrestle back some of that territory. To the Asian markets, battling some softer CPI numbers as we just fleshed out in the headlines. And you can see the trade across the region is downbeat today. The Hong Kong market sliding 0.75%. The Shanghai Composite, the only one out of the mix, trying to put in a bit of green. Steve.
Thank you very much. And just speaking to our next guest, who you're going to bring in a moment. Minutes from the Fed's March meeting. We didn't talk about the minutes. They show officials, let's be brutally honest about it, they didn't move the needle too much, but they did show officials expressing concern that inflation wasn't easing quickly enough. FOMC members said interest rates are at their peak. Whoa, I'm going to put it, that's what they say. There are some people beginning to put a question mark after that. And changing the words, are they at their peak? With an expectation, though, from the Fed that they will still cut this year. Officials said rates would stay on hold until they gained greater confidence that price pressures were firmly on their way back to the Fed's 2% target.
And let's get to Eric Norlin, who is senior economist, CME Group. Eric, nice to see you in studio again. And let me just pick up on the data that we've seen. I mean, we used to say that there's no point putting too much stock in one piece of data, but it's not one piece of data anymore. We've had a couple of in the series in CPI. We've seen it in the wages. We've seen it in the jobs numbers. There's a whole different series of data points suggesting that the disinflationary trend we had back end of last year is now starting to wane this year. Is that a concern?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's a concern. And we saw that yesterday in the bond market with yields on 2- and 3-year treasuries rising by 20 basis points after that number. I think what was particularly interesting about yesterday's number, so core inflation, as we all know, along with headline inflation, surprised 0.1% on the high side. So it comes in at 3.8%. Now, if you take that and you break it into two parts, so the last 6 months annualized and the previous 6 months annualized, over the course of the second and third quarter last year, we're looking at 3.6% annualized core inflation. In the fourth quarter and the first quarter, that rose up to 4%. So this downtrend in core inflation we've been seeing is now apparently stabilized or maybe even slightly reversed.
The components that really accounted for half of the increase, shelter and gasoline. Gasoline, it doesn't feel as though the Fed could do too much. It's not OPEC or OPEC Plus these days. The shelter side...
The US is the biggest producer of oil in the world.
Yes, but this is not the Fed, even if it is...
The authorities in the US do control... a lot about how much oil can permits, for instance.
But not through monetary policy, which is my point for the Fed, right? And if we go back to the other part that is in the mix that the Fed can do something about, that is shelter. And you've got to say, the longer we keep rates higher, doesn't that feed through into shelter as well? Because rents are going up as some of the landlords seek to recoup some of their high mortgage costs?
Well, that's right, yes. Yeah. So not only are landlords seeking to recoup their higher mortgage costs, but mortgage rates themselves have gone from 3% to 8%. So a lot of would-be buyers are forced into the rental market, and the rental market has near record low vacancy rates. So you have a lot of people trying to compete over a small number of properties.
Do you know what? Karen is right to pick me up on, of course, on it's not the Fed, but I was talking about the authorities. But this is I probably wasn't going to go this way, but I'm going to go this way now. This is a political headache for Biden, who actually by and large is presiding over a pretty solid economy. You'd prefer to be Biden on the economic front than Ursula von der Leyen, for instance, or Olaf Scholz, because, you know, US is doing pretty... Let's look at the bright side. This is an economy that is defying expectations to the upside. That's a nice problem to have, but it's a bad problem for the administration as well, because people just don't feel wealthy, do they?
Well, you know, I think that it's a tough question, right? So on the one hand, we have an incredibly strong job market. You know, we had 300,000 jobs created last month, very, very steady job creation, unemployment below 4%, wages are rising at around 4%, but you have core inflation also up near almost at 4% as well. So people, I think, kind of feel like they're on a treadmill. You know, they're earning more money, but they're not really moving anywhere.
And then bringing it back to the Fed, which is where we kicked off. Again, I have so many impactful interviews, and we love chatting to you, Eric. So thank you for coming in nice and early as well. But one thing that was brought into stark notice of me a couple of days ago was Richard Coote of Nomura again, just reminded me just how much money there is in excess banking reserves. And I can't help thinking when the market's hoping for 25 basis points, 50 basis points, whatever it is they're hoping for this year as well now as well, when you've got a balance sheet, excess banking reserves, 1,700 times what it was pre-Lehman, I was wondering if we're knocking at the wrong door to try and work out how we get inflation down.
Well, you know, the Fed raised rates by 500 basis points. So that's sending everybody's cost of financing much, much higher. So the Fed raised 500 basis points. Credit card loans are up 700 basis points. They went from 14.5% to 21.5%. Yeah. You have huge increase in mortgage costs, auto loans. And a lot of this is feeding through also into small businesses, which tend to borrow money directly from banks. They're seeing much higher financing costs. So I do think that the Fed's rate hikes, which, you know, completed almost 9 months ago, are eventually going to feed through the economy.
As we talk about the financial tightening from monetary policy conditions, in the last number of weeks, it feels like we've had some financial loosening on markets as those expectations have been really baked in around 3 rate cuts for this year. As some of that gets taken away or swept aside by the markets, what sort of financial tightening could come back into markets and what impact would that then have on the Fed?
Well, you know, I think that the market's expectations, right, they have changed dramatically. When we began this year in January, the market was actually pricing 6 Fed rate cuts. Now it's not even quite pricing 3. It's kind of between 2 and 3 rate cuts. So the market, in a sense, is tightening policy on behalf of the Fed by moving more in line with what the Fed has been saying all along about their intentions. But I think that the impact of rate hikes tends to impact the economy with a delay of about 1 to 2 years. So I don't think we've really seen the impact of the tightening much at all yet.
Just finally, can you spell out for us the playbook for the Fed then? So when do we see the first cut in your view, and how many do we get this year?
Well, it's tough. You know, I think it really depends on what kind of data we get over the next few months. Up until yesterday, the market had still been pricing a majority chance we got a cut in June. Now the market thinks that's down to around 20%. So unless we get some weak data out over the course of the second quarter, it's going to be tough for the Fed to cut in June. And then it gets tough in July and September because you have the election coming up. So it's kind of either June or maybe November.
Yeah, and how tough that's going to be for the dear old ECB that would love to hold hands with Jay Powell doing their first cut in June. That's made it really tricky for them. Lovely to see you, Eric. Thank you so much indeed for joining us nice and early and giving us the benefit of all your wonderful knowledge as well. Eric Norland, senior economist, CME Group as well. And we'll talk about it constantly. Let's be brutally honest about it. But for more on the hot inflation print that has pushed the market's rate cut expectations mainly to September, check out CNBC.com. Jeff Cox done a great piece there as well. In the opposite direction, Chinese factory gate prices extended declines into their 18th straight month in March, falling 2.8% on the year. Consumer prices posted sluggish growth, up 0.1% on the year, weaker than expected and well down on the previous month. Lynn joins us now. Lynn, just talk us through what's going on in the opposite direction over in China from the States.
Yeah, it is indeed. And certainly when we look at the consumer price picture, we saw upside in February, but a lot of economists were warning that there was the seasonal distortions with the longer than usual Lunar New Year holiday really pushing up prices when it comes to services, when it comes to food as well. But for the month of March, we did see it was a miss. So 0.1% increase on the CPI front when the expectation was 0.4%. Certainly, what this is really painting is a picture here that when it comes to the consumer sentiment here, it is still weak. You've got the folks over at Nomura in a note saying that really that is still coming from the overhang from the property sector, the liquidity crunch there. When you look at the numbers, that is still ongoing and it doesn't appear to be going away anytime soon. Now, as you were noting there on the producer price side, it was another fall at 2.8%, the 18th straight month. And certainly, you've got economists talking about this oversupply issue, which of course has been dominating the headlines with Janet Yellen visiting China and raising this issue. We are seeing intense competition when it comes to certain sectors like your EVs and solar panels. We're seeing prices being cut there, even in terms of construction materials as well, like your zinc smelters. And whilst that is helping from the export side, and we are seeing that in the data from the first quarter, of course, that is fueling the trade tensions. And interestingly as well, in the last 24 hours, we did get upgrades in terms of the growth forecast from a number of brokerages, including Goldman Sachs, as well as Morgan Stanley, also Asian Development Bank. They've all revised to around 5% or close to 5%. But certainly, of course, as I said, fueling those trade tensions, not only with the US, but also with the EU as well. Now, in terms of the policy support, the folks over at Capital Economics, they say that the room for any kind of major monetary easing is really limited, given, of course, the wide yield differential. And then, of course, in terms of the CPI print, we got stateside showing, of course, that this narrative in terms of higher for longer appearing to last for this year. And then just in terms of the economic data going forward, we will get trade tomorrow and we will also get Q1 GDP. That will drop next week. So that will give us, guys, more of an indication of how China's economy is tracking this year.
Thank you so much for that then, Lynn. Now, coming up on the show, the $1.7 trillion question. How should regulators make sure that UBS doesn't go the way of Credit Suisse? Well, we'll discuss that next. Plus, we'll get the latest numbers then out of Publicis this hour. That comes after the advertising giant posted a beat in the fourth quarter. And it's a big macro day here in Europe then, with the ECB set to make its latest policy decision this afternoon. We'll have special coverage for you on that. That's coming up from 2 p.m. CET.
Ambition to me is about doing better.
I think ambition creates a pathway.
The best advice I can give someone starting off a career is don't have a career, have lots of careers, try loads of different things.
Talk to people and put your ambition out there.
I don't feel that I've hit peak ambition because it's a learning journey.
CNBC is where ambition meets opportunity. What does living ambitiously mean to you? Hear it from our CNBC anchors, reporters, and global business leaders on CNBC.com.
Let me ask you a question before I go into the next read. Whose fault was Credit Suisse? I don't know the answer, and I think there's multiple answers to that question. But It certainly wasn't UBS's fault, was it? I think we can say that. I think it wasn't UBS's fault. I mean, what happened to their rival across the square in Zurich?
We'll give you that, yes.
Well, yeah. I'm just saying that because on the back of this next segment, I think you all probably know where I'm going with this already, but let's just go through this next segment, then I'll open it up. Because the Swiss government has now strengthened its rules for the country's banking sector, saying UBS and three other systemically relevant lenders have to substantially raise their capital levels. Now, in a new report to how to police banks that are deemed too big to fail, the Swiss Federal Council also proposed better backstop measures and suggested the country's market regulator, FINMA, should be given more powers. So just that in mind, was it UBS's? We don't think so. We don't think UBS had a capital problem, no? All right. Okay, good. Well, glad we're all on the same page. Swiss Finance Minister Karin Kelter-Suter said the new measures were aimed at protecting the wider economy.
Oberstes Ziel des Bundesrates ist es.
The highest goal of the Federal Council is to protect the taxpayers and the economy. What happened with Credit Suisse must not repeat itself. It must be prevented that a banking crisis becomes a threat to the Swiss economy. In order to achieve this goal, the Federal Council proposes targeted and effective measures. We need higher equity capital requirements, better liquidity, and measures against management failures and excessive bonuses.
Right, so the highest goal of regulators and politicians is to obviously protect the consumer and protect the investors and protect the Swiss economy, yeah? So they failed, yeah? Just chucking it out there. Last week at the Ambrosetti Forum, the UBS CEO, Sergio Ermotti, told me that European banks needed to become more competitive and said the lenders' merger with Credit Suisse will serve as a case study for the future.
In many countries, there is a recognition that they want to protect their banks and their financial institutions as national champions, which is an implied or explicit recognition of their value for their economies. But the bad news is that they don't realize that in order to really be meaningful and go to the next level of their contribution in their economies, they would need to be also more competitive globally. And so, but without a banking union, without a capital market union, it's going to be very, very difficult for Europe to compete with U.S. large banks. And fundamentally, you all know that the economies and are still relying in Europe to the banking sector for financing for 70% of the business of the cases. In the U.S., it's the other way around. So we have a completely different playing field and lack of critical mass. So I hope, I'm not so convinced it's going to happen soon, but I hope eventually one day those kind of mergers between larger banks will be allowed.
So UBS, which came in to pick up the pieces, yeah? But who are they picking up the pieces? Let's listen to Kelter-Suter again, just the top of what she had to say. I just want to make the point one more time.
Oberstes Ziel des Bundesrates ist es.
The highest goal of the Federal Council is to protect the taxpayers and the economy.
Right, what happened? Okay, there we go. The highest goal of the federal government is to protect the taxpayers and the economy. So, Sylvia Morrow, they failed ignominiously. So rather than looking at the banks that are still there, that have great capital requirements, that are growing their business aggressively, do they need to resign themselves and say, we failed, because it was us, the government, that failed to regulate properly Credit Suisse?
There's no acknowledgement of any guilt here whatsoever. And actually, I would like to bring up this comment from UBS itself. The CEO and also the chairman, they wrote a letter to shareholders a couple of weeks back, and they made that exact point. They said that ultimately, Credit Suisse's troubles were essentially Credit Suisse's. It was a broken business model, and therefore, that this does not require additional regulation. They also said it was not a lack of capital to force Credit Suisse into a historic weekend rescue. All in all, what we heard from UBS thus far, which I have to say they declined to comment off the back of the announcement from the Federal Council, UBS has made it very clear that they do not see this as a problem in the banking sector in Switzerland, that this was a Credit Suisse problem. So let's see what will happen. What we heard from the Federal Council was that they are putting forward 22 measures to be implemented as soon as possible. There's other measures in this report to be debated in the future. But those 22 measures, what markets were focusing on yesterday was the need to increase capital requirements. Now, just looking at some of the numbers from UBS, they have a CET1 ratio above 14%, and they have said that their target is to reach 18% of CET1 capital ratio by 2028. So they are working already hard to have a strong balance sheet. With that in mind, though, the fact that the government was asking for stronger capital requirements has led to the shares falling yesterday. They were down by almost 3% during the session. And at one point, actually, they were even halted. Ultimately, if you look at the performance over the last 12 months and you compare that with the likes of Deutsche Bank or even Morgan Stanley, now a lot of talk about whether UBS is the European Morgan Stanley, you can see that the shares are trading higher compared to these peers because this deal was seen as basically a boost here for UBS. I also spoke with an equity analyst yesterday to understand what is the community feeling about this. And he made the point that ultimately this report is not changing his thoughts on the bank. That what they care about is the integration, and that's what they're looking at. That will be the point of focus when UBS results come out in early May. Ultimately, the fact that the regulators are asking for more capital requirements was not seen as a huge surprise. However, that still led to a down move in the shares.
The reality is we may never have to worry about UBS for years, but there could be one day when the chickens come home to roost under different management, different twists and turns around the economic journey, different risk-taking that happens. And what has been created here now, some call it a monster bank that could capsize the Swiss economy. And that is concerning, isn't it? Not what happened with Credit Suisse necessarily, but what has been created in the wash-up from Credit Suisse, whether that does pose some sort of systemic risk to Switzerland and also to Europe.
You can also understand where the regulators are coming from and the government are coming from. They now have a bank that is basically twice the size of the Switzerland economy. So there's huge risks here, because if something similar to what happened to Credit Suisse were to happen with UBS, the shocks would be huge, and there's no essentially other big bank that could come and rescue UBS.
Or even something different that happened to Credit Suisse that happened to UBS.
Yeah.
I mean, it could be different factors, right? And one thing that's been cited, even as we talk about regulation in Switzerland, is that you have a bank that has so many overseas subsidiaries. How to regulate those offshore entities is also very difficult for one country in particular. You need some sort of accord internationally from international regulators.
Sorry, this is palpably not the case. This is a bank that had something enormous thrown at it. Its biggest internal peer in Switzerland, one of the biggest banks in Switzerland, was unambiguously calamitous. And throughout this whole process, UBS was strong and robust and had strong internal controls. The problem surely lies in the fact that the internal and external regulation of Credit Suisse was incompetent or something worse. And the other point is, so what are we saying? That we can't have large banks in Europe? That we can't have banks that rival the behemoths that are in the United States? We can't have a JP Morgan, we can't have a Goldman Sachs, we can't have a Morgan Stanley, because we're worried about the ramifications. Look at the malaise we're seeing throughout Europe. Look at the logjam we're seeing on banking integration throughout the continent. Look at the problems we're having with CMU, the lack of capital market access for companies. Is it any connection? I'm just asking this. The malaise we've got in the European economy with the ability to finance on a global scale. Are these things connected?
It is a structural problem too. You can't compare, you can't compare the United States and the European Union, also not think about the fact that here you have different countries, different legislations, different laws. And ultimately, that is the problem on why we don't see more bigger European banks.
You know, I don't think a lot of people think it's a great thing having massive US banks either. I mean, in the wash-up from the regional bank crisis last year, there was a view that there was a flight of money back to a couple of main players, and that was not seen as a great thing for systematic importance too.
But thank goodness that we did have big, solid, safe, well-regulated, well-capitalized US banks.
That worked last time around, but that doesn't mean it works every time in future. If you keep on growing these institutions, eventually get to the point. I mean, look at the Titanic. It was great to have a big ship and big ship that was a little bit top-heavy. I mean, do you want that when it comes to banks across Europe?
I think comparing regulated US banks to Titanic is a bit of a stretch, I've got to be honest. For a start, it was a poorly designed ship. If we're really going to go into the White Star Line, Titanic built in the 1910s.
But this is the point. Is that what we're creating now when it comes to the wash-up from the situation in Switzerland?
So you're saying we should have smaller US banks?
I'm just asking. No, I'm saying When it comes to Switzerland, are we creating a bank that is too big for that economy?
What about
to the United States? Are we creating banks that are also too large for the US economy? Should we have more diversity in some of the major players?
The diversity didn't work. The diversity was where the problem was. These small regional banks, which didn't have the right kind of liquidity when it counted, was where the problem is. Thank goodness that actually during that crisis,
the oversight of some of these smaller banks, because they were seen as not relevant enough to regulate, but in fact they were relevant.
Of course they were regulated.
Not to the same extent as the too big to fail banks.
Karen, there's something, having worked in the bank, there's something called risk management. And if you don't adhere to risk management, and you have a treasury as well, you have accountants, and then you have external regulators as well. There were multiple failures inside and outside at those regional banks as well. And it's the same case at Credit Suisse as well. If you have bigger banks, I'm not saying you should have just bigger banks. I'm saying these big banks have such enormous restrictions on them as well, and forensic focus on their capital levels as well. That's good news, isn't it?
It is good news, but I think you have to be...
So how can you compare them to the Titanic then?
I think you've got to be mindful of the size of a bank that you're creating, and you know the comparison about
the
size. But the size of UBS now, that is twice the size of the Swiss economy. I mean, does anybody not see that as a problem? If you're underwriting underwriting business across border, surely that's a problem, isn't it?
Depends what do you want, ultimately. You can understand the both sides. If you want to have a strong European bank...
because what I want is a strong European economy.
Then if you want a strong European bank...
I want better capital markets.
Then you will also need the regulation. We also need strong regulation. We need to look at this and understand that if a bank is bigger, naturally their capital requirements have to be bigger too.
But that UBS isn't denying that.
They are not denying that. They're saying their balance sheet is strong. Looking at the numbers, they are pretty strong. The uncertainty here comes from the fact that the regulators and the legislators are saying they need a stronger capital requirements, but they don't say by how much. It's ultimately up to UBS to decide. I'll just make a final point that this is just the start of a lot of conversations when it comes to regulation. We are not expecting this to be implemented as soon as immediately, I should say. It might only happen at the start of next year. So let's see how these conversations will go, because ultimately politicians could still change their mind in the parliament.
And we've still got parliamentary...
Exactly.
We're just highlighting how differently we all feel about the issue. And I think that's not just around the studio.
What, you don't want big, strong banks in Europe?
I don't want massive, massive entities with a lot of money locked up on balance sheet because they have to meet regulatory rules and are too top-heavy for the size of an economy. No, I don't. I think it's a risk. Thank you for listening to Squawk Box Europe Express.
For more market-moving news, you can head to cnbc.com or join us again on the show with me, Steve Sedgwick, and Karen Cho, weekdays on CNBC.